With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us here on the AgNet News Hour for this Friday morning. Coming up later, how macroeconomic factors are taking their toll on agriculture. But to start us off today, it's all about improving the future of agriculture. Michael Clements reports.
To strengthen the future of agriculture, Bayer Fund's Grow Ag Leaders program will once again partner with farmers to award scholarships to students pursuing careers in any agriculture-related field of study. Grow Ag Leaders program representative Jackie Greenblatt says the program was developed to help encourage rural students to pursue careers in agriculture and emphasizes there are many eligible careers both on and off the farm.
The agriculture industry is growing, and the type of in-demand jobs expand well beyond traditional roles such as farming and agronomy. There are jobs in engineering, mathematics, data science, communications, and countless others. Students who are pursuing careers in these areas are eligible to apply for a Grow Ag Leaders Scholarship.
Greenblatt encourages students enrolled or planning to enroll in trade schools, community college, and four-year universities to apply for the $1,500 scholarships.
The program is available to students pursuing ag-related degrees at either a trade school, community college, or traditional four-year university. They just need to have a GPA of 2.5 or higher to qualify. Each applicant must be an FFA member and also needs to receive an endorsement from two local farmers. The program is open now until January 11th, 2024.
Greenblatt emphasizes that the Bayer Fund has a long history of giving back to local rural communities through its various community outreach programs, helping farmers to further strengthen their communities.
Through the Bayer Fund, we've awarded over $65 million to rural communities since 2010. The Grow Ag Leaders program alone has awarded more than $4 million in scholarships to over 2,000 students across the U.S., and this year, we will be giving away over 350 scholarships, totaling more than $500,000.
To learn more about the program, Greenblatt says students should go online to www.fund.bayer.us.
There, students will find information about the program as well as a link to the FFA website to apply. Again, the deadline to apply is January 11th, 2024, and farmer endorsements must be submitted by January 18th, 2024.
Again, learn more online at www.fund.bayer.us. That was Jackie Greenblatt with Bayer, encouraging students in your area to go online and apply today for this scholarship. Don't delay. Applications close on January 11th. Michael Clements reporting.
USDA has many options for farm borrowers who are having trouble making their loan payments. Gary Crawford has more.
If you are a farmer with a USDA loan and you don't think you will be able to make the loan payment, or if you are already behind in your payments, there could still be some help available from a couple of programs under the Inflation Reduction Act, programs that have been created because of the tenuous and risky nature of the farming business today.
The farmers that feed our country and our world often operate on razor-thin margins.
Yes, they do, which can easily quickly turn into no margins or negative margins. This from USDA Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small. She says farmers can sometimes find themselves in trouble through no fault of their own.
Sometimes it's meant missed payments. Other times it's meant farmers who have taken out a second mortgage or who had to take on a high interest loan or cash out their retirement in order to keep going. That's why President Biden, through the IRA, has worked to create a reset, to add some breathing room for farmers.
So far, $1.8 billion worth of breathing room for about 32,000 farmers. Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau says the deadline to apply for the Inflation Reduction Act programs is coming very soon, December 31st. So not a lot of time there, but he says check with your local FSA office, Farm Service Agency, to find out the full array of help available, even beyond those Inflation Reduction Act programs.
So loan servicing is still an option. Loan restructuring is still an option to make sure that it better aligns with their production practices and helps them keep more of that production income on the farm.
Ducheneau says farmers having financial trouble, if they come in, they'll likely experience what he calls
a significant change in the approach to the struggles of our producers
with USDA being much more flexible to the needs of those producers. As Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack puts it,
the star of the show here, the person that really matters, is the farmer, and keeping that farmer, him or her, on the land.
That's the main objective.
Keeping farmers farming.
So that they can be a better participant in that rural economy.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour, and now we go to a special segment from our livestock reporter, Will Jordan.
In today's livestock news, to most people, 20 years ago is a distant memory. It was the year that the business social media platform LinkedIn was launched, iTunes Music made its debut, and the iPhone was still 4 years away. For cattle producers, another landmark event came at the end of 2003. The first confirmed case of BSE in the United States was announced by then U.S. Secretary of Ag Ann Veneman on December 23rd.
Today, we received word from USDA's National Veterinary Services Laboratories in Ames, Iowa, that a single Holstein cow from Washington State has tested as presumptive positive for BSE, or what is widely known as mad cow disease.
Worse than the Grinch, the cow that stole Christmas upended the U.S. cattle industry, disrupted the global beef supply chain, took imported international market share from U.S. beef, and raised food safety concerns among American citizens.
Despite this finding, we remain confident in the safety of our food supply. The risk to human health from BSE is extremely low.
Still grappling with events from just 2 years prior, the American public needed assurance that this disease was not an act of terror and needed confidence that Christmas could go on as planned.
I would emphasize that based on the information available, this incident is not terrorist related, nor is it related in any way to our nation's heightened alert status. I cannot stress this point strongly enough. The safety of our food supply and public health are high priorities of this administration and high priorities of USDA. At this time of year, many Americans are making plans for the holidays and for food. We see no need for people to alter those plans or their eating habits or to do anything but have a happy and healthy holiday season. I plan to serve beef for my Christmas dinner, and we remain confident in the safety of our food supply.
As a novel disease to the United States at the time, the seismic impact that the mad cow announcement would have on the U.S. beef industry shifted Christmas cheer toward market failure fears.
We are in the process of notifying a whole range of people at this point, including our trading partners, and I can't at this point anticipate what they may do in response to this announcement.
While Secretary Veneman's team in D.C. sorted through the initial announcement of BSE, across the country in Greeley, Colorado, then trade official for Swift & Company and now president and CEO of U.S. Meat Export Federation, Dan Hallstrom, began running through the possible ramifications to come.
The first thing that went through our minds was, well, will this impact international? And those of us in the international realm knew it would. Then that begs other questions. Well, will all markets be impacted equally, blah, blah, blah? There's a million things going through your mind. And the reality is when we found out on December 23rd of 2003 in the afternoon, Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman gave a press release, a news conference. We actually had a news conference on the TV. We were watching it. And when we hung up for that news conference, there was only a few of us in the office, including our CEO. And, well, the question kind of was, well, will this impact us? And my response was, well, I'm sure it already has. We just don't know it.
Though the cause of trade barriers, market closures, and consumer panic, the real danger of the cow that stole Christmas was found between overreaction and misinformation. Though technically safe for consumption, the mention of disease put consumers on high alert. Political pressure and lack of consumer understanding about the disease caused the hype and hysteria that dropped U.S. beef export value by nearly a million metric tons and nearly $8 billion.
There was a whole bunch of things going on, and the overall mode of the messaging which is always the concern, was that the messaging got really out of whack. It was turned into a food safety concern, when in actuality, the science would say it was only an animal health concern, not a food safety concern at all. So that's where it got really murky. And over time, we got that all figured out, that, you know, really, there is no food safety concern around BSE. It's an animal health concern, right? And but it took a while. It took many years to get that sorted out. And a good example on that is Korea. I mean, Korea had other things going on at the same time. About the time, I don't have the exact dates right in front of me, but about the time we were reintroducing U.S. beef after the shutdown, you know, I want to say it was probably in the 2006, 7, 8 range, it corresponded with a presidential election in Korea. So it got, that was one of the things that the opposition party at the time was really focusing in on, because the party in control supported the resumption of beef exports. And yeah, you could just see how it would be easy to get off track, and the story got in the way of the facts, so to speak.
Back in D.C. at USDA's initial press conference, Elsa Morano, Agriculture Undersecretary for Food Safety, explained for consumers which tissue is actually affected by BSE.
Infectious tissues from an animal that has BSE, that is the central nervous system tissues, the brain, spinal cord, and so forth, of this animal did not enter the food supply. Those tissues went to rendering, so they did not enter the food supply. That's very important to know.
The last trade restriction on U.S. beef because of BSE was finally knocked down in May of 2019, nearly 16 years after the first confirmed case. Beyond the impact it had on beef export value and domestic sales, looking back 20 years on the cow that stole Christmas, we can see the importance of animal disease prevention, crisis management, and effective communication.
You know, you always expect it to go quicker than it does. And so that's kind of a learning going forward. You know, what's the next BSE? Well, high path avian influenza might have been an example that seemed to be handled. I mean, while it was very disruptive, and I'm not a poultry guy, but as it was very disruptive, I'm sure there were some learnings from BSE that were put to good use with that, with the avian influenza situation. And it appears that they've rebounded and adjusted much quicker than we did with BSE. FMD comes to mind, which would infect all cloven-hoofed animals, you know, beef, pork, lamb, et cetera. African swine fever is another one, which would be, of course, the swine side. And then there's the unknown, right? What don't we know about?
An immunologically naive U.S. livestock herd leaves the door open for another, more serious contagious disease to wreak havoc on the U.S. cattle industry and more. Looking ahead, to prevent another much worse collapse of livestock trade and red meat exports, key action must be taken.
That's the learning, is to the extent you can prepare ahead of time for the unknown with these trading partners. And I would argue that FAS, the Foreign Ag Service, is one way to do that. Have good relationships, have good communication, open and honest communication. If you have that kind of relationship built up before there's a situation like this, you're going to have that much more of a chance to adjust quicker and more efficiently. So that's one takeaway.
Producers and legislators should be cognizant of animal health issues abroad, communicating with trading partners, ready to direct the conversation surrounding an outbreak, and prepared to weather the uncomfortable livestock markets that will follow. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
American Pistachio Growers has secured a $5 million grant from the California Department of Food and Agriculture as part of the California Healthy Soils Initiative. The grant is one of 14 funded through the CDFA Healthy Soils Block Grant Pilot Program, distributing $62 million in 2023. APG plans to assist growers in implementing qualified projects to enhance soil health, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and increase yields. The program supports practices such as compost application, cover crop planting, hedgerow planting, nutrient management, and prescribed grazing. Grower applications open on January 1st with APG anticipating funding over 30 projects prioritizing socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers or those with farms of 500 acres or less. Applications will be accepted from growers in Kern, Tulare, Kings, Fresno, Madera, and Merced counties. Results are in for World Ag Expo's 2024 Top 10 New Products Competition. The winners will be showcased February 13th through 15th during the World Ag Expo in Tulare. The impressive field of new products were submitted for the contest by exhibitors of the largest annual agricultural show of its kind. Products ranged from simple solutions to autonomous robots. Featured businesses include Blue White, Gus Automation, Verdant Robotics, Country Enterprises, Sharkwheel Agriculture, Burrow, Sutton Ag Enterprises, Farm NG, OMC Orchard Machinery Corp., and Tractor Protection Products. The contest judges consisted of farmers, ranchers, and industry professionals. Winners will be noted on show maps marked with top 10 winner flags at the show and recognized during an award session at the opening ceremonies on Tuesday, February 13th. Several macroeconomic factors are taking their toll on agriculture. Senior analyst covering fruits and tree nuts for Rabo AgriFinance, David Magana, detailed some of the outside forces putting pressure on farmers.
We continue to see persistent inflation, elevated interest rates that now everybody is expecting to see higher interest rates for a longer period of time. So putting that in perspective, interest rates are like a historical average for the past 40 years. And it doesn't feel well when we come from a very low level of interest rates and how fast they have been increasing and the cost of much needed capital to implement innovation, to bring efficiencies and remain in the industry. And at the same time, we still are discussing consumers trading down because of this elevated inflation and still the possibility of a recession.
Three-cornered alfalfa hoppers appear to prefer food sources outside of vineyards. Professor of plant pathology at Cornell University, Mark Fuchs, said that while the pest does feed on some grapes, wine grape vineyards are not necessarily at risk.
What we also found is, particularly in Napa, there are obviously vineyard settings, but there are also many wild grapes. So grapes like Vitis californica that grow in ditches, in riparian areas, along riverbanks and so forth. And these are the preferred grapes that they feed upon. They don't like so much wine grapes. They prefer wild grapes to feed upon. So that was also interesting news, indicating again that they spend more time outside vineyard settings than within vineyards.
A research report suggests an innovative solution for California's water management concerns focusing on shallow subsurface artificial groundwater recharge. Conducted at the Fresno State Farm in 2021 and 2022, the research reveals that this method outperforms basins in terms of both effectiveness and cost, avoiding evaporation losses and being 6 to 8 times less expensive for the same size. The state's Sustainable Groundwater Management Act aims to address overdraft issues, encouraging technologies like shallow subsurface recharge. This system, characterized by leach line structures releasing water 6 to 12 feet below the surface, is highlighted for its 100% efficiency and its minimal disruption to farming. The Shallow Subsurface Artificial Groundwater Recharge Report also highlights its compatibility with existing irrigation systems, large-scale implementation feasibility, and prevention of leaching contaminants into groundwater. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The Agriculture Secretary makes a case for SNAP funding. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters this week why he wants full funding for the SNAP program.
You know, I think it's important to understand what the SNAP program does. In my view, it does four things. It provides access to food for folks who are struggling financially. It supports jobs along the entire food supply chain, because if people can purchase more at the grocery store, they will. Right. And if they purchase more, it needs to be packaged and processed and trucked and so forth. You know, 15 cents of every SNAP dollar spent at a grocery store goes to a farmer. So it's connected to farm income. And I would make the case that having nutrition assistance programs maintains some degree of social stability. Because if you look at the world today where there's strife and difficulty and anger and passion, two things are pretty much absolutely certain of every single one of those locations. a lot of unemployed people, and a lot of hungry people. So the SNAP program, I think, is really important.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. The recent United Nations Climate Change Conference gave opportunity for U.S. leadership to showcase domestic and international agricultural approaches to addressing climate issues. Rod Bain looks at some of those efforts presented at COP28 in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The uniqueness of the recent United Nations Climate Change Conference was not lost on those in the ag sector and those participating in the 28th edition, a COP that for the first time provided a major focus on food production and agriculture as a climate mitigator and problem solver.
In fact, I would say that in this COP, we flipped the script for American agriculture. There was no need for us to be defensive, but in fact, we could articulate proactive leadership in the climate space.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was among the members of the U.S. delegation to COP28. The event in the United Arab Emirates provided opportunity for the secretary to highlight domestic and international climate mitigation efforts. I'm Rod Bain. And coming up, Ag and Forestry Spotlight at COP28 in this edition of Agriculture USA. The world gathered in Dubai earlier this month to participate in the 28th edition of the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP28 for short. And those in the food, farm, and forestry realm participating in the conference recognized this particular COP was a watershed event for their sectors. It was the first such COP to put ag and forestry as climate solutions in the forefront. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack noted one day at the event was set aside to recognize
Food and Agriculture Day, one of the special days, and highlighted at COP28.
And because of the elevation of food and ag into a prominent role at COP28 and climate mitigation efforts in general,
152 nations have already executed and signed on to the declaration that was proposed by the UAE in the area of food and agriculture, a declaration that outlines the steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that we can produce the food necessary to meet the nutrition needs of the world now and in the future in light of a changing climate and the challenges that it presents.
Secretary Vilsack's participation at COP28 included several sessions and high-level events, such as programs updating the latest advances in the Agriculture Innovation Mission, AIM for Climate.
AIM for Climate partners have more than doubled the total increased investment in climate-smart agriculture and food system innovation from $8 billion at COP27 to $17 billion today. We've more than doubled the number of innovation sprints since COP27 to 78, and we've more than doubled the number of partners since COP27 to over 600 now at COP28, including 55 government partners.
Another focal point of U.S. climate mitigation efforts, the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities, creating markets for commodities and services that are value-added through climate-smart production practices.
We specifically designed this opportunity to appeal to all types of farmers, from large farms to small family farm operations, across all major commodities, including a diverse range of farmer demographics. The project involves nearly 100 universities, including over 30 minority-serving institutions.
USDA is also part of a domestic initiative called America the Beautiful, designed to conserve 30% of U.S. lands and waters by the year 2030.
When it was structured, it was intended to reflect a broad range of efforts by ranchers and farmers, fishermen and women, forest owners, tribal nations, and communities to safeguard the health and the integrity of the lands and waters upon which all of us depend. For USDA, a critical part of the initiative is the inclusion of private working lands that are the backbone of many rural communities.
Other notable domestic climate mitigation efforts include
efforts of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and USDA in making a continued commitment to focus on reducing food loss and waste, which is a driver of significant methane into the atmosphere, and also had a chance to underscore the important work that we're doing in forest management and restoration under our wildfire crisis strategy designed to reduce hazardous fuel buildup in our forests so that we can reduce the risk of catastrophic fire.
While globally,
we were able to focus on and showcase our International Climate Hub, which was launched at the summit that was held in Washington, D.C. last spring. This provides information to showcase some of the tools that have been developed by USDA and made available on the International Climate Hub.
An example of such tools is
Comet Farm Planner. It's a offtake of our Comet Farm tool that's used by farmers in the United States to determine the benefit of certain conservation practices on their land.
The secretary also had bilateral discussions while at COP28.
With my counterparts in Chile, France, the UK, and Mexico.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
On a special segment this Friday before Christmas, U.S. Founding Father Alexander Hamilton is a big musical star, but he has not eclipsed Santa in popularity. Gary Crawford has more.
And now, in the style of the big Broadway hit Hamilton,
here comes the Santa Claus,
the pride of the North Pole.
Yes,
here comes the Santa Claus,
Nicholas.
Yes, Santa, an ancient and familiar part of our holidays, and he's as hot today as old Alexander Hamilton is today. But how did Santa get his start?
Well, there was a real St. Nicholas who was a bishop of Asia Minor in the 4th century.
That's Agriculture Department historical expert Ann Effland, who says, yes, St. Nick was real, but even in the study of history, the line between truth and legend can be blurred a bit.
The legend is that he was a patron of children, watched out for children. He's also the patron saint of sailors. And although many different cultures have a Santa Claus figure or have adopted St. Nicholas, it was the Dutch who really created the Santa Claus that we know in America.
Only this St. Nick evidently didn't have reindeer. He had a donkey, yes. And the kids put their wooden shoes by the fireplace after putting straw in them to feed the donkey, of course. And in return, St. Nick left a little gift in the shoe. Hopefully the donkey didn't do the same thing.
St. Nicholas in Dutch was Sint Niklas.
And when the Dutch came to the New World, to New Amsterdam, they changed the shoes to stockings. After all, you can get a lot more stuff in there. And also, they took Sint Nicholas.
And then they shortened it to Sinterklaas, and that's where Santa Claus comes from in the American English.
And speaking of English, in Puritan England, they rejected the Catholic-oriented Saint Nicholas in favor of something else.
And I believe in Father Christmas.
Yes, there was a Father Christmas in England, Papa Noel in France, and other countries had their versions, but in this country, many of these began to sort of come together and were really given life in 1823.
Was the night before Christmas and all through the house.
Dr. Clement Clark Moore's poem, The Night Before Christmas, and Ann Effland says,
it includes a lot of the, you know, the reindeer on the roof and the stockings by the hearth and all of those bits and pieces that we associate with the Santa Claus legend.
To add to the words of Clement Moore, later on came the pictures of Santa that cartoonist Thomas Nast drew in Harper's Weekly magazine. He drew those between 1863 and 1886.
And over the course of that time, the Santa that we know evolved through his cartoons, including the idea that Santa was at the North Pole and was building toys all year round, that he got letters from the children requesting toys, that he kept track of which children behaved and didn't behave.
He's making a list, checking it twice.
Yes, and the most recent change in Santa's appearance, which has been accepted, showed up in the 1930s in a series of ads and calendars by the Coca-Cola Company, yes, who made him even older, fatter, more grandfatherly, and thirsty, of course, but still our basic Saint Nick. And so in just a little while, we'll rise up.
Here comes the Santa Claus.
Rise up, yeah.
Here comes the Santa Claus.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. We go to Chuck Zimmerman now for this interview.
I'm visiting with Bruce Knight, and Bruce, you're here at the ASTA Field Crop Seed Convention. That's a newly named meeting that they've had for many, many years, and now moved to Orlando. You moderated one of our panels here today, and it was very interesting. This was on the Climate Smart Ag Partnerships. Maybe the first thing to do would be to just define what those are.
Well, the Department of Agriculture announced a grant program about a year and a half ago. They awarded over $3 billion to 141 different partnerships that are in various ways trying to find ways to create market value associated with climate smart agriculture. carbon sequestration, methane avoidance, nitrous oxide reductions in the atmosphere, any way that you could find a way to connect the dollars and cents of the marketplace to farmer actions. Most of these dollars are supposed to go on the ground. It's been in process for about a year now, various projects slowly getting off the ground in 2023. I expect things to really take off now in the winter of 2024 with opportunities for farmers to sign up. In many of the Midwest states, if you're in Iowa or Illinois, you're going to have dozens of folks coming down your lane asking you to be involved in one of these projects. And it's going to be everything from cover crops to feed management and their cattle to all sorts of opportunities that encourage farmers to take a look at and find something that may make sense in their operation.
Yeah, there and with ASTA, the cover crops is something that they're working on, and has some interesting statistics about, you know, what is the percentage of farmers who are actually using cover crops. I knew it was small, but I didn't know it was quite as small as it is. But that's maybe because we've talked with a lot of farmers who are doing it. But what are some of the other things that we're hearing a whole lot about? It's kind of got the carbon word in it, it's mm-hmm. or sequestration of and carbon markets even. Are those included in those types of work that's being done?
Yes, they are. So throughout commodity agriculture in the Midwest, a lot of opportunities are going to be out there on cover crops, which are obvious. Probably today about 8% of the acres have cover crops, so there's great opportunities for involvement. No-till, minimum till, transfer from conventional till to that is another carbon smart practice that's going to be used a lot. We're expecting new products to be coming in the market around feed additives that will be out there in very short order. So you're going to be able to add something to a cow's diet and reduce her enteric fermentation, the belching, by maybe as much as 20 to 30% without reducing milk or beef production. So there's a host of these things, some large 20% gains, others that are 3 or 5% gain. And all of this rolls up to be climate smart agriculture. What's excited about it for me as a lifelong conservationist is many times it's traditional conservation practices. It's keep something green and growing. It's keep cover on the ground, minimize tillage, the stuff we've known for a long time. But now we're going to have the resources to take it at scale. You know, instead of having programs that only allow 40 acres of cover crops, you're going to be able to do 4,000. That's a big difference in a farm operation.
Well, we've certainly, over the last couple of years now, you know, soil health has been a real key word, if you will, that farmers or companies are being able to come out with new forms of nitrogen or whatever it might be. That seems to be a real growing area, along with biologicals as well.
Absolutely. And biological and soil health seem to be very closely linked. You know, many times these biologicals are actually triggering root growth or something in the soil that will either sequester more carbon or, more viable, would allow a plant to pull more nitrogen out of the air and for its own growth and its own use. It's really exciting ways in which we have the greening of entrepreneurship occurring right now. I mean, I see more startups doing everything from virtual fences for cows to biologicals that help the critters in the soil talk to the roots. Believe it or not, they do talk to each other, and each stimulates the other and grows more and results in greater yield in the corn. These are exciting times, and the entrepreneurship around climate smart agriculture is really exciting.
So you had an audience there. What kind of questions did they pose to your panel?
They ran the full range from what's the best way to measure, report, and verify the carbon sequestration in the soil to does a cover crop work in a dry state? you know, and what about the impacts on soil moisture? And it's that practicality that is so vital. One of the key things on cover crops, everybody wants to know how many acres do they need, especially at this convention, because these guys grow seed, and they need an advance warning. And so we're trying to put as much transparency into these programs so that business platforms can adapt and be able to respond on seed availability, seed demand, each of those things.
At this point, with these, with the USDA Climate Smart projects, have they fulfilled their budget? Is that something that they're still, or companies able to maybe make a proposal?
These Climate Smart projects are really just getting started. But I see it not as a continual grant program. It's been kind of a one and done, a special thing that Secretary Vilsack was able to put in place at USDA. However, I do see an opportunity coming up within the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have something called a Regional Conservation Partnership Program that is opening the door in the same way for business, cooperatives, and farmers and NGOs in the conservation community to put in proposals about what they can do on traditional conservation as well as climate smart agriculture. That's going to open probably in January, February of next year, and it will be a large opportunity to continue to do these things. So collaborative partnerships on conservation work, and there's funding out there that's going to be available for them.
Anything else we didn't touch on there that you know heard or might want to pass along from this panel that you had?
And the biggest thing here is that for a farmer, and I know most of your listeners are farmers, this winter, take a look under the hood of these programs when folks come to you. Some of the folks are, if it sounds like it's too good to be true, it probably is. But some of them are going to be worth a look. And especially if, as a farmer conservationist myself, I'm always looking for the things I would like to do on my ranch that I can't afford to do myself. If I can find a partner that'll help pay for that, that's better for the environment, I want to take a look at that. And I know every farmer and rancher is in that situation. You're going to have opportunities this winter like you've never had before as a result of these and other grant opportunities out there. Know what you want to change. Know what you want to do on your farm. When those guys come knocking, ask them, will you help me on what I want to do instead of what you may want me to do?
Good point, good point. Well, thank you very much, Bruce, for taking time to visit here at ASTA's Field Crop Seed Convention. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
We'll be right back. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. The estate tax is back in conversations across Washington, D.C. Chad Smith has more on opposition to the death tax.
The American Farm Bureau Federation was part of a letter to Congress expressing opposition to the estate tax. Dustin Shearer, Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau, talks about what was in the letter.
The Family Business Estate Tax Coalition, of which American Farm Bureau Federation is a member, sent a letter to Representatives Steenstra and Bishop, who plan on introducing the Death Tax Repeal Act in the House, hopefully sometime in mid-January. Farm Bureau has long been opposed to any type of estate tax, and this particular bill would take the estate tax completely off the books.
The large number of groups signed on to the letter, including those that represent a variety of businesses outside of agriculture, shows how important the issue is to the overall economy.
It's very indicative of how important it is to small, privately held, family-owned businesses, farms, ranches. The estate tax is oftentimes talked about only with reference to somebody with a farm or a ranch trying to pass down a business from one generation to the next. But you apply those same principles to a family-owned small business that manufactures products or a family-owned construction company.
The American Farm Bureau has long been an outspoken opponent of the death tax.
For some reason, somebody at some point in history thought that somebody dying was a good enough reason to levy a tax on all of the assets that they had accumulated. We have always been philosophically just opposed to that. This particular tax makes it very difficult to transition a business from one generation to the next, which in many cases is all families want to do is keep the family in the business. It's provided for the family over the course of one generation. They want to make sure that it's there for the next.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Are there any signals pointing to an end to beef herd contraction? Gary Crawford looks into it.
For over a year now, the beef cattle industry's been in a contraction phase. Cow-calf operators putting more animals into feedlots than normal, younger than normal. Producers seem to be saying,
I'm going to put this calf and send it to the feedlot and take the money now,
rather than holding more calves back for breeding. USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says, at the moment, of course, cattle numbers are still shrinking. We're looking for something to signal a change in the way things are going. Of course, naturally,
if folks hold on to those calves, then we're kind of saying, hey, we'll make a turn and we'll hit the bottom and we'll start producing more beef at some point in the future. So far, there aren't any signals that said we've hit that point.
Traders and producers are going to be looking for some clues in two upcoming USDA reports, this Friday's monthly feedlot report. More importantly, in USDA's twice yearly cattle inventory report that comes out January 31st.
That may tell us quite a bit.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.